event. Many readers now want fact-checking as part of traditional news stories as well. They will vocally complain to ombudsmen and readers' representatives when they see news stories repeating discredited factual claims. This ethic would have served us well in earlier decades, when false rumors regularly set off pogroms, riots, lynchings, and wars, including the Spanish-American War in 1898, the escalation of the Vietnam War in 1964, the Iraq invasion of 2003, and many others. It was not applied rigorously enough to prevent Trump's victory in 2016, but since then his fibs and those of his spokespeople have been mercilessly ridiculed in the media and popular culture, which means that the resources for favoring truth are in place, even if they don't always carry the day. Over the long run, the institutions of reason can mitigate the tragedy of the belief commons and allow the truth to prevail. For all of our current irrationality, few influential people today believe in werewolves, unicorns, witches, alchemy, astrology, bloodletting, miasmas, animal sacrifice, the divine right of kings, or supernatural omens in rainbows and eclipses. Moral irrationality can be outgrown as well. As recently as my childhood, the Virginia judge Leon Bazile upheld the conviction of Richard and Mildred Loving for their interracial marriage, with an argument that not even the most benighted conservative would advance today. The parties were guilty of a most serious crime. It was contrary to the declared public law, founded upon motives of public policy, upon which social order, public morality, and the best interests of both races depend. Almighty God created the races white, black, yellow, Malay, and red, and he placed them on separate continents. The fact that he separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix. And presumably most liberals would not be persuaded by this defense of Castro's Cuba by the intellectual icon Susan Sontag in 1969. The Cubans know a lot about spontaneity, gaiety, sensuality, and freaking out. They are not linear, desiccated creatures of print culture. In short, their problem is almost the obverse of ours, and we must be sympathetic to their efforts to solve it. Suspicious as we are of the traditional Puritanism of left revolutions, American radicals ought to be able to maintain some perspective. When a country known mainly for dance music, prostitutes, cigars, abortions, resort life, and pornographic movies gets a little uptight about sexual morals and, in one bad moment 2 years ago, rounds up several thousand homosexuals in Havana and sends them to a farm to rehabilitate themselves. In fact, these farms were forced labor camps, and they arose not as a correction to spontaneous gaiety and freaking out, but as an expression of a homophobia that was deeply rooted in that Latin culture. Whenever we get upset about the looniness of public discourse today, we should remind ourselves that people weren't so rational in the past, either. What can be done to improve standards of reasoning? Persuasion by facts and logic, the most direct strategy, is not always futile. It's true that people can cling to beliefs in defiance of all evidence, like Lucy in Peanuts, who insisted that snow comes out of the ground and rises into the sky, even as she was being slowly buried in a snowfall. But there are limits as to how high the snow can pile up. When people are first confronted with information that contradicts a staked-out position, they become even more committed to it, as we'd expect from the theories of identity-protective cognition, motivated reasoning, and cognitive dissonance reduction. Feeling their identity threatened, belief holders double down and muster more ammunition to fend off the challenge. But since another part of the human mind keeps a person in touch with reality, as the counter-evidence piles up, the dissonance can mount until it becomes too much to bear, and the opinion topples over, a phenomenon called the effective tipping point. The tipping point depends on the balance between how badly the opinion holder's reputation would be damaged by relinquishing the opinion, and whether the counter-evidence is so blatant and public as to be common knowledge, a naked emperor, an elephant in the room. As we saw in Chapter 10, that is starting to happen with public opinion on climate change, and entire populations can shift when a critical nucleus of persuadable influencers changes its mind and everyone else follows along, or when one generation is replaced by another that doesn't cling to the same dogmas. Progress, funeral by funeral. Across the society as a whole, the wheels of reason often turn slowly, and it would be nice to speed them up. The obvious places to apply this torque are in education and the media. For several decades, fans of reason have pressured schools and universities to adopt curricula in critical thinking. Students are advised to look at both sides of an issue, to back up their opinions with evidence, and to spot logical fallacies like circular reasoning, attacking a straw man, appealing to authority, arguing ad hominem, and reducing a graded issue to black or white. Related programs called debiasing try to inoculate students against cognitive fallacies such as the availability heuristic and confirmation bias. When they were first introduced, these programs had disappointing outcomes, which led to pessimism as to whether we could ever knock sense into the person on the street. But unless risk analysts and cognitive psychologists represent a superior breed of human, something in their education must have enlightened them about cognitive fallacies and how to avoid them. And there is no reason those enlightenments can't be applied more widely. The beauty of reason is that it can always be applied to understand failures of reason. A second look at critical thinking and debiasing programs has shown what makes them succeed or fail. The reasons are familiar to education researchers. Any curriculum will be pedagogically ineffective if it consists of a lecturer yammering in front of a blackboard or a textbook that students highlight with a yellow marker. People understand concepts only when they are forced to think them through, to discuss them with others, and to use them to solve problems. A second impediment to effective teaching is that pupils don't spontaneously transfer what they learned from one concrete example to others in the same abstract category. Students in a math class who learn how to arrange a marching band into even rows using the principle of a least common multiple are stymied when asked to arrange rows of vegetables in a garden. In the same way, students in a critical thinking course who are taught to discuss the American Revolution from both the British and American perspectives will not make the leap to consider how the Germans viewed World War I. With these lessons about lessons under their belt, psychologists have recently devised debiasing programs that fortify logical and critical thinking curricula. They encourage students to spot, name, and correct fallacies across a wide range of contexts. Some use computer games that provide students with practice and with feedback that allows them to see the absurd consequences of their errors. Other curricula translate abstruse mathematical statements into concrete, imaginable scenarios. Tetlock has compiled the practices of successful forecasters into a set of guidelines for good judgment. For example, start with the base rate. Seek out evidence and don't overreact or underreact to it. Don't try to explain away your own errors, but instead use them as a source of calibration. These and other programs are provably effective. Students' newfound wisdom outlasts the training session and transfers to new subjects. Despite these successes, and despite the fact that the ability to engage in unbiased critical reasoning is a prerequisite to thinking about anything else, few educational institutions have set themselves the goal of enhancing rationality. This includes my own university, where my suggestion during a curriculum review that all students should learn about cognitive biases fell deadborn from my lips. Many psychologists have called on their field to give debiasing away as one of its greatest potential contributions to human welfare. Effective training in critical thinking and cognitive debiasing may not be enough to cure identity-protective cognition, in which people cling to whatever opinion enhances the glory of their tribe and their status within it. This is the disease with the greatest morbidity in the political realm. And so far, scientists have misdiagnosed it, pointing to irrationality and scientific illiteracy instead of the myopic rationality of the tragedy of the belief commons. As one writer noted, scientists often treat the public the way Englishmen treat foreigners. They speak more slowly and more loudly. Making the world more rational, then, is not just a matter of training people to be better reasoners and setting them loose. It also depends on the rules of discourse in workplaces, social circles, and arenas of debate and decision-making. Experiments have shown that the right rules can avert the tragedy of the belief commons and force people to dissociate their reasoning from their identities. One technique was discovered long ago by rabbis. They forced yeshiva students to switch sides in a Talmudic debate and argue the opposite position. Another is to have people try to reach a consensus in a small discussion group. This forces them to defend their opinions to their group mates, and the truth usually wins. Scientists themselves have hit upon a new strategy called adversarial collaboration, in which mortal enemies work together to get to the bottom of an issue, setting up empirical tests that they agree beforehand will settle it. Even the mere requirement to explicate an opinion can shake people out of their overconfidence. Most of us are deluded about our degree of understanding of the world, a bias called the illusion of explanatory depth. Though we think we understand how a zipper works, or a cylinder lock, or a toilet, as soon as we are called upon to explain it, we are dumbfounded and forced to confess we have no idea. That is also true of hot-button political issues. When people with die-hard opinions on Obamacare or NAFTA are challenged to explain what those policies actually are, they soon realize that they don't know what they are talking about, and become more open to counter-arguments. Perhaps most important, people are less biased when they have skin in the game, and have to live with the consequences of their opinions. In a review of the literature on rationality, the anthropologists Hugo Mercier and Dan Sperber conclude, contrary to common bleak assessments of human reasoning abilities, people are quite capable of reasoning in an unbiased manner, at least when they are evaluating arguments rather than producing them, and when they are after the truth rather than trying to win a debate. The way that the rules in particular arenas can make us collectively stupid or smart can resolve the paradox that keeps popping up in this chapter. Why the world seems to be getting less rational in an age of unprecedented knowledge and tools for sharing it. The resolution is that in most arenas, the world has not been getting less rational. It's not as if hospital patients are increasingly dying of quackery, or planes are falling out of the sky, or food is rotting on wharves because no one can figure out how to get it into stores. The chapters on progress have shown that our collective ingenuity has been increasingly successful in solving society's problems. Indeed, in one realm after another, we are seeing the conquest of dogma and instinct by the armies of reason. Newspapers are supplementing shoe leather and punditry with statisticians and fact-checking squads. The cloak-and-dagger world of national intelligence is seeing farther into the future by using the Bayesian reasoning of super-forecasters. Healthcare is being reshaped by evidence-based medicine, which should have been a redundant expression long ago. Psychotherapy has progressed from the couch and notebook to feedback-informed treatment. In New York, and increasingly in other cities, violent crime has been reduced with the real-time data-crunching system called CompStat. The effort to aid the developing world is being guided by the randomistas, economists who gather data from randomized trials to distinguish fashionable boondoggles from programs that actually improve people's lives. Volunteering and charitable giving are being scrutinized by the effective altruism movement, which distinguishes altruistic acts that enhance the lives of beneficiaries from those that enhance the warm glow in benefactors. Sports has seen the advent of Moneyball, in which strategies and players are evaluated by statistical analysis rather than intuition and lore, allowing smarter teams to beat richer teams and giving fans endless new material for conversations over the hot stove. The blogosphere has spawned the rationality community, who encourage people to be less wrong in their opinions by applying Bayesian reasoning and compensating for cognitive biases. And in the day-to-day functioning of governments, the application of behavioral insights, sometimes called nudge, and evidence-based policy, has wrung more social benefits out of fewer tax dollars. In area after area, the world has been getting more rational. There is, of course, a flaming exception, electoral politics, and the issues that have clung to it. Here the rules of the game are fiendishly designed to bring out the most irrational in people. Voters have a say on issues that don't affect them personally and never have to inform themselves or justify their positions. Practical agenda items like trade and energy are bundled with moral hot buttons like euthanasia and the teaching of evolution. Each bundle is strapped to a coalition with geographic, racial, and ethnic constituencies. The media cover elections like horse races and analyze issues by pitting ideological hacks against each other in screaming matches. All of these features steer people away from reasoned analysis and toward perfervid self-expression. Some are products of the misconception that the benefits of democracy come from elections, whereas they depend more on having a government that is constrained in its powers, responsive to its citizens, and attentive to the results of its policies. Chapter 14. As a result, reforms that are designed to make governance more democratic, such as plebiscites and direct primaries, may instead have made governance more identity-driven and irrational. The conundrums are inherent to democracy and have been debated since the time of Plato. They have no instant solution, but identifying the worst of the current problems and setting the goal of mitigating them is the place to start. When issues are not politicized, people can be altogether rational. Kahan notes that bitter public disputes over science are in fact the exception rather than the rule. No one gets exercised over whether antibiotics work or whether driving drunk is a good idea. Recent history proves the point in a natural experiment, complete with a neatly matched control group. The human papillomavirus, HPV, is sexually transmitted and a major cause of cervical cancer, but can be neutralized with a vaccine. Hepatitis B is also sexually transmitted, also causes cancer, and also can be prevented by a vaccine. Yet HPV vaccination became a political firestorm, with parents protesting that the government should not be making it easier for teenagers to have sex, while hepatitis B vaccination is unexceptionable. The difference, Kahan suggests, lies in the way the two vaccines were introduced. Hep B was treated as a routine public health matter, like whooping cough or yellow fever. But the manufacturer of the HPV vaccine lobbied state legislatures to make vaccination mandatory, starting with adolescent girls, which sexualized the treatment and raised the dander of puritanical parents. To make public discourse more rational, issues should be depoliticized as much as is feasible. Experiments have shown that when people hear about a new policy, such as welfare reform, they will like it if it is proposed by their own party, and hate it if it is proposed by the other, all the while convinced that they are reacting to it on its objective merits. That implies that spokespeople should be chosen carefully. Several climate activists have lamented that by writing and starring in the documentary An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore may have done the movement more harm than good, because as a former Democratic vice president and presidential nominee, he stamped climate change with a left-wing seal. It's hard to believe today, but environmentalism was once denounced as a right-wing cause, in which the gentry frivolously worried about habitats for duck hunting and the views from their country estates, rather than serious issues like racism, poverty, and Vietnam. Recruiting conservative and libertarian commentators who have been convinced by the evidence and are willing to share their concern would be more effective than recruiting more scientists to speak more slowly and more loudly. Also, the factual state of affairs should be unbundled from remedies that are freighted with symbolic political meaning. Kahan found that people are less polarized in their opinion about the very existence of anthropogenic climate change when they are reminded of the possibility that it might be mitigated by geoengineering than when they are told that it calls for stringent controls on emissions. This does not, of course, mean that geoengineering itself need be advocated as the primary solution. Depoliticizing an issue can lead to real action. Kahan helped a compact of Florida business people, politicians, and resident associations, many of them Republican, agree to a plan to adapt to rising sea levels that threatened coastal roads and freshwater supplies. The plan included measures to reduce carbon emissions, which under other circumstances would be politically radioactive. But as long as the planning was focused on problems they could see and the politically divisive backstory was downplayed, they acted reasonably. For their part, the media could examine their role in turning politics into a sport, and intellectuals and pundits could think twice about competing. Can we imagine a day in which the most famous columnists and talking heads have no predictable political orientation, but try to work out defensible conclusions on an issue-by-issue basis? A day in which you're just repeating the left-wing or right-wing position is considered a devastating gotcha? In which people, especially academics, will answer a question like, does gun control reduce crime, or does a minimum wage increase unemployment, with, wait, let me look up the latest meta-analysis, rather than with a patellar reflex predictable from their politics. A day when writers on the right and left abandon the Chicago way of debating. They pull a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue.
And adopt the arms controller's tactic of graduated reciprocation in tension reduction.
Make a small, unilateral concession with an invitation that it be reciprocated. That day is a long way off. But the self-healing powers of rationality, in which flaws in reasoning are singled out as targets for education and criticism, take time to work. It took centuries for Francis Bacon's observations on anecdotal reasoning and the confusion of correlation with causation to become second nature to scientifically literate people. It's taken almost 50 years for Tversky and Kahneman's demonstrations of availability and other cognitive biases to make inroads into our conventional wisdom. The discovery that political tribalism is the most insidious form of irrationality today is still fresh and mostly unknown. Indeed, sophisticated thinkers can be as infected by it as anyone else. With the accelerating pace of everything, perhaps the countermeasures will catch on sooner. However long it takes, we must not let the existence of cognitive and emotional biases, or the spasms of irrationality in the political arena, discourage us from the Enlightenment ideal of relentlessly pursuing reason and truth. If we can identify ways in which humans are irrational, we must know what rationality is. Since there is nothing special about us, our fellows must have at least some capacity for rationality as well. And it's in the very nature of rationality that reasoners can always step back, consider their own shortcomings, and reason out ways to work around them. Chapter 22. Science. If we were called upon to name the proudest accomplishments of our species, whether in an intergalactic bragging competition or in testimony before the Almighty, what would we say? We could crow about historic triumphs in human rights, such as the abolition of slavery and the defeat of fascism. But however inspiring these victories are, they consist in the removal of obstacles we set in our own path. It would be like listing in the achievements section of a resume that you overcame a heroin addiction. We would certainly include the masterworks of art, music, and literature. Yet, would the works of Aeschylus or El Greco or Billie Holiday be appreciated by sentient agents with brains and experiences unimaginably different from ours? Perhaps there are universals of beauty and meaning that transcend cultures and would resonate with any intelligence. I like to think there are, but it is devilishly difficult to know. Yet there is one realm of accomplishment of which we can unabashedly boast before any tribunal of minds, and that is science. It's hard to imagine an intelligent agent that would be incurious about the world in which it exists, and in our species that curiosity has been exhilaratingly satisfied. We can explain much about the history of the universe, the forces that make it tick, the stuff we're made of, the origin of living things, and the machinery of life, including our mental life. Though our ignorance is vast and always will be, our knowledge is astonishing and growing daily. The physicist Sean Carroll argues in The Big Picture that the laws of physics underlying everyday life, that is, excluding extreme values of energy and gravitation like black holes, dark matter, and the Big Bang, are completely known. It's hard to disagree that this is one of the greatest triumphs of human intellectual history. In the living world, more than 1.5 million species have been scientifically described, and with a realistic surge of effort, the remaining 7 million could be named within this century. Our understanding of the world, moreover, consists not in mere listings of particles and forces and species, but in deep, elegant principles, such as that gravity is the curvature of space-time, and that life depends on a molecule that carries information, directs metabolism, and replicates itself. Scientific discoveries continue to astound, to delight, to answer the formerly unanswerable. When Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA, they could not have dreamed of a day when the genome of a 38,000-year-old Neanderthal fossil would be sequenced and found to contain a gene connected to speech and language, or when an analysis of Oprah Winfrey's DNA would tell her she was descended from the Pella people of the Liberian rainforest. Science is shedding new light on the human condition. The great thinkers of antiquity, the Age of Reason, and the Enlightenment were born too soon to enjoy ideas with deep implications for morality and meaning, including entropy, evolution, information, game theory, and artificial intelligence, though they often tinkered with precursors and approximations. The problems these thinkers introduced to us are today being enriched with these ideas and are being probed with methods such as 3D imaging of brain activity and the mining of big data to trace the propagation of ideas. Science has also provided the world with images of sublime beauty, stroboscopically frozen motion, flamboyant fauna from tropical rainforests and deep-sea ocean vents, graceful spiral galaxies and diaphanous nebulae, fluorescing neural circuitry, and a luminous planet Earth rising above the moon's horizon into the blackness of space. Like great works of art, these are not just pretty pictures, but prods to contemplation, which deepen our understanding of what it means to be human and of our place in nature. And science, of course, has granted us the gifts of life, health, wealth, knowledge, and freedom documented in the chapters on progress. To take just one example from Chapter 6, scientific knowledge eradicated smallpox, a painful and disfiguring disease which killed 300 million people in the 20th century alone. In case anyone has skimmed over this feat of moral greatness, let me say it again. Scientific knowledge eradicated smallpox, a painful and disfiguring disease which killed 300 million people in the 20th century alone. These awe-inspiring achievements put the lie to any moaning that we live in an age of decline, disenchantment, meaninglessness, shallowness, or the absurd. Yet today the beauty and power of science are not just unappreciated, but bitterly resented. The disdain for science may be found in surprising quarters, not just among religious fundamentalists and know-nothing politicians, but among many of our most adored intellectuals and in our most august institutions of higher learning. The disrespect of science among American right-wing politicians has been documented by the journalist Chris Mooney in The Republican War on Science, and has led even stalwarts, such as Bobby Jindal, the former governor of Louisiana, to disparage their own organization as the Party of Stupid. The reputation grew out of policies set in motion during George W. Bush's administration, including his encouragement of the teaching of creationism in the guise of intelligent design, and the shift from a long-standing practice of seeking advice from disinterested scientific panels to stacking the panels with congenial ideologues, many of whom promoted flaky ideas, such as that abortion causes breast cancer, while denying well-supported ones, such as that condoms prevent sexually transmitted diseases. Republican politicians have engaged in spectacles of inanity, such as when Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee, brought a snowball onto the Senate floor in 2015 to dispute the fact of global warming. The previous chapter warned us that the stupidification of science in political discourse mostly surrounds hot buttons like abortion, evolution, and climate change. But the scorn for scientific consensus has widened into a broadband know-nothingness. Representative Lamar Smith of Texas, chair of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, has harassed the National Science Foundation not just for its research on climate science, which he thinks is a left-wing conspiracy, but for the research in its peer-reviewed grants, which he pulls out of context to mock. For example, how does the federal government justify spending over $220,000 to study animal photos in National Geographic? He has tried to undermine federal support of basic research by proposing legislation that would require the NSF to fund only studies that promote the national interest, such as defense and the economy. Science, of course, transcends national boundaries. As Chekhov noted, there is no national science, just as there is no national multiplication table. And its ability to promote anyone's interests comes from its foundational understanding of reality. The global positioning system, for example, uses the theory of relativity. Cancer therapies depend on the discovery of the double helix. Artificial intelligence adapts neural and semantic networks from the brain and cognitive sciences. But Chapter 21 prepared us for the fact that politicized repression of science comes from the left as well. It was the left that stoked panics about overpopulation, nuclear power, and genetically modified organisms. Research on intelligence, sexuality, violence, parenting, and prejudice have been distorted by tactics ranging from the choice of items in questionnaires to the intimidation of researchers who fail to ratify the politically correct orthodoxy. My focus in the rest of this chapter is on a hostility to science that runs even deeper. Many intellectuals are enraged by the intrusion of science into the traditional territories of the humanities, such as politics, history, and the arts. Just as reviled is the application of scientific reasoning to the terrain formerly ruled by religion. Many writers without a trace of a belief in God maintain that it is unseemly for science to weigh in on the biggest questions. In the major journals of opinion, scientific carpetbaggers are regularly accused of determinism, reductionism, essentialism, positivism, and worst of all, a crime called scientism. This resentment is bipartisan. The standard case for the prosecution by the left may be found in a 2011 review in The Nation by the historian Jackson Lears. Positivism depends on the reductionist belief that the entire universe, including all human conduct, can be explained with reference to precisely measurable, deterministic physical processes. Positivist assumptions provided the epistemological foundations for social Darwinism and pop evolutionary notions of progress, as well as for scientific racism and imperialism. These tendencies coalesced in eugenics, the doctrine that human well-being could be improved and eventually perfected through the selective breeding of the fit and the sterilization or elimination of the unfit. Every school kid knows about what happened next, the catastrophic 20th century, two world wars, the systematic slaughter of innocents on an unprecedented scale, the proliferation of unimaginably destructive weapons, brushfire wars on the periphery of empire. All these events involved, in various degrees, the application of scientific research to advanced technology. The case from the right is captured in this 2007 speech from Leon Kass, Bush's bioethics advisor. Scientific ideas and discoveries about living nature and man, perfectly welcome and harmless in themselves, are being enlisted to do battle against our traditional religious and moral teachings and even our self-understanding as creatures with freedom and dignity. A quasi-religious faith has sprung up among us. Let me call it soulless scientism, which believes that our new biology, eliminating all mystery, can give a complete account of human life, giving purely scientific explanations of human thought, love, creativity, moral judgment, and even why we believe in God. The threat to our humanity today comes not from the transmigration of souls in the next life, but from the denial of soul in this one. Make no mistake. The stakes in this contest are high. At issue are the moral and spiritual health of our nation, the continued vitality of science, and our own self-understanding as human beings and as children of the West. All friends of human freedom and dignity, including even the atheists among us, must understand that their own humanity is on the line. These are zealous prosecutors indeed. But as we shall see, their case is trumped up. Science cannot be blamed for genocide and war, and does not threaten the moral and spiritual health of our nation. On the contrary, science is indispensable in all areas of human concern, including politics, the arts, and the search for meaning, purpose, and morality. The highbrow war on science is a flare-up of the controversy raised by C.P. Snow in 1959, when he deplored the disdain for science among British intellectuals in his lecture and book, The Two Cultures. The term cultures, in the anthropologist's sense, explains the puzzle of why science should draw flack not just from fossil fuel-funded politicians, but from some of the most erudite members of the clerisy. During the 20th century, the landscape of human knowledge was carved into professionalized duchies, and the growth of science, particularly the sciences of human nature, is often seen as an encroachment on territories that had been staked and enclosed by the academic humanities. It's not that practitioners of the humanities themselves have this zero-sum mindset. Most artists show no sign of it. The novelists, painters, filmmakers, and musicians I know are intensely curious about the light that science might shed on their media, just as they are open to any source of inspiration. Nor is the anxiety expressed by the scholars who delve into historical epics, genres of art, systems of ideas, and other subject matter in the humanities, since a true scholar is receptive to ideas regardless of their origin. The defensive pugnacity belongs to a culture. Snow's second culture of literary intellectuals, cultural critics, and erudite essayists. The writer Damon Linker, citing the sociologist Daniel Bell, characterizes them as specialists in generalizations, pronouncing on the world from out of their individual experiences, habits of reading, and capacity for judgment. Subjectivity, in all of its quirks and eccentricities, is the coin of the realm in the Republic of Letters. This modus could not be more different from the way of science, and it's the second culture intellectuals who most fear scientism, which they understand as the position that science is all that matters, or that scientists should be entrusted to solve all problems. Snow, of course, never held the lunatic position that power should be transferred to the culture of scientists. On the contrary, he called for a third culture, which would combine ideas from science, culture, and history, and apply them to enhancing human welfare across the globe. The term was revived in 1991 by the author and literary agent John Brockman, and it is related to the biologist E.O. Wilson's concept of consilience, the unity of knowledge, which Wilson in turn attributed to, who else? The thinkers of the Enlightenment. The first step in understanding the promise of science in human affairs is to escape the bunker mentality of the second culture, captured, for example, in the tagline of a 2013 article by the literary lion Leon Wieseltier, "Now science wants to invade the liberal arts. Don't let it happen." An endorsement of scientific thinking must first of all be distinguished from any belief that members of the occupational guild called science are particularly wise or noble. The culture of science is based on the opposite belief. Its signature practices, including open debate, peer review, and double-blind methods, are designed to circumvent the sins to which scientists, being human, are vulnerable. As Richard Feynman put it, the first principle of science is that you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. For the same reason, a call for everyone to think more scientifically must not be confused with the call to hand decision-making over to scientists. Many scientists are naïfs when it comes to policy and law, and cook up non-starters like world government, mandatory licensing of parents, and escaping a befouled earth by colonizing other planets. It doesn't matter, because we're not talking about which priesthood should be granted power. we're talking about how collective decisions can be made more wisely. A respect for scientific thinking is, adamantly, not the belief that all current scientific hypotheses are true. Most new ones are not. The lifeblood of science is the cycle of conjecture and refutation, proposing a hypothesis and then seeing whether it survives attempts to falsify it. This point escapes many critics of science who point to some discredited hypothesis as proof that science cannot be trusted, like a rabbi from my childhood who rebutted the theory of evolution as follows. Scientists think the world is 4 billion years old. They used to think the world was 8 billion years old. If they can be off by 4 billion years once, they can be off by 4 billion years again. The fallacy, putting aside the apocryphal history, is a failure to recognize that what science allows is an increasing confidence in a hypothesis as the evidence accumulates, not a claim to infallibility on the first try. Indeed, this kind of argument refutes itself, since the arguers must themselves appeal to the truth of current scientific claims to cast doubt on the earlier ones. The same is true of the common argument that the claims of science are untrustworthy because the scientists of some earlier period were motivated by the prejudices and chauvinisms of the day. When they were doing bad science, and it's only the better science of later periods that allows us, today, to identify their errors. One attempt to build a wall around science and make science pay for it uses a different argument, that science deals only with facts about physical stuff, so scientists are committing a logical error when they say anything about values or society or culture. As Wieseltier puts it, it is not for science to say whether science belongs in morality and politics and art. Those are philosophical matters, and science is not philosophy. But it is this argument that commits a logical error, by confusing propositions with academic disciplines. It's certainly true that an empirical proposition is not the same as a logical one, and both must be distinguished from normative or moral claims. But that does not mean that scientists are under a gag order forbidding them to discuss conceptual and moral issues, any more than philosophers must keep their mouths shut about the physical world. Science is not a list of empirical facts. Scientists are immersed in the ethereal medium of information, including the truths of mathematics, the logic of their theories, and the values that guide their enterprise. Nor for its part has philosophy ever confined itself to a ghostly realm of pure ideas that float free of the physical universe. The Enlightenment philosophers in particular interwove their conceptual arguments with hypotheses about perception, cognition, emotion, and sociality. Hume's analysis of the nature of causality, to take just one example, took off from his insights about the psychology of causality, and Kant was, among other things, a prescient cognitive psychologist. Today most philosophers, at least in the analytic or Anglo-American tradition, subscribe to naturalism, the position that reality is exhausted by nature, containing nothing supernatural, and that the scientific method should be used to investigate all areas of reality, including the human spirit. Science, in the modern conception, is of a piece with philosophy, and with reason itself. What, then, distinguishes science from other exercises of reason? It certainly isn't the scientific method, a term that is taught to school children but that never passes the lips of a scientist. Scientists use whichever methods help them understand the world, drudge-like tabulation of data, experimental derring-do, flights of theoretical fancy, elegant mathematical modeling, kludgy computer simulation, sweeping verbal narrative. All the methods are pressed into the service of two ideals, and it is these ideals that advocates of science want to export to the rest of intellectual life. The first is that the world is intelligible. The phenomena we experience may be explained by principles that are deeper than the phenomena themselves. That's why scientists laugh at the theory of the brontosaurus from the dinosaur expert on Monty Python's Flying Circus. All brontosauruses are thin at one end, much, much thicker in the middle, and then thin again at the far end. The theory is just a description of how things are, not an explanation of why they are the way they are. The principles making up an explanation may in turn be explained by still deeper principles, and so on. As David Deutsch put it, we are always at the beginning of infinity. In making sense of our world, there should be few occasions on which we are forced to concede, it just is, or it's magic, or because I said so. The commitment to intelligibility is not a matter of raw faith, but progressively validates itself as more of the world becomes explicable in scientific terms. The processes of life, for example, used to be attributed to a mysterious élan vital. Now we know they are powered by chemical and physical reactions among complex molecules. Demonizers of scientism often confuse intelligibility with a sin called reductionism, the analysis of a complex system into simpler elements, or, according to the accusation, nothing but simpler elements. In fact, to explain a complex happening in terms of deeper principles is not to discard its richness. Patterns emerge at one level of analysis that are not reducible to their components at a lower level. Though World War I consisted of matter in motion, no one would try to explain World War I in the language of physics, chemistry, and biology, as opposed to the more perspicuous language of the perceptions and goals of leaders in 1914 Europe. At the same time, a curious person can legitimately ask why human minds are apt to have such perceptions and goals, including the tribalism, overconfidence, mutual fear, and culture of honor that fell into a deadly combination at that historical moment. The second ideal is that we must allow the world to tell us whether our ideas about it are correct. The traditional causes of belief, faith, revelation, dogma, authority, charisma, conventional wisdom, hermeneutic parsing of texts, the glow of subjective certainty, are generators of error and should be dismissed as sources of knowledge. Instead, our beliefs about empirical propositions should be calibrated by their fit to the world. When scientists are pressed to explain how they do this, they usually reach for Karl Popper's model of conjecture and refutation, in which a scientific theory may be falsified by empirical tests, but is never confirmed. In reality, science doesn't look much like skeet shooting, with a succession of hypotheses launched into the air like clay pigeons and shot to smithereens. It looks more like Bayesian reasoning, the logic used by the super-forecasters we met in the preceding chapter. A theory is granted a prior degree of credence based on its consistency with everything else we know. That level of credence is then incremented or decremented according to how likely an empirical observation would be if the theory is true, compared with how likely it would be if the theory is false. Regardless of whether Popper or Bayes has the better account, a scientist's degree of belief in a theory depends on its consistency with empirical evidence. Any movement that calls itself scientific, but fails to nurture opportunities for the testing of its own beliefs, most obviously when it murders or imprisons the people who disagree with it, is not a scientific movement. Many people are willing to credit science with giving us handy drugs and gadgets, and even with explaining how physical stuff works. But they draw the line at what truly matters to us as human beings, the deep questions about who we are, where we came from, and how we define the meaning and purpose of our lives. That is the traditional territory of religion, and its defenders tend to be the most excitable critics of scientism. They are apt to endorse the partition plan proposed by the paleontologist and science writer Stephen Jay Gould in his book Rocks of Ages, according to which the proper concerns of science and religion belong to non-overlapping magisteria. Science gets the empirical universe, religion gets the questions of morality, meaning, and value. But this entente unravels as soon as you begin to examine it. The moral worldview of any scientifically literate person, one who is not blinkered by fundamentalism, requires a clean break from religious conceptions of meaning and value. To begin with, the findings of science imply that the belief systems of all the world's traditional religions and cultures, their theories of the genesis of the world, life, humans, and societies, are factually mistaken. We know, but our ancestors did not, that humans belong to a single species of African primate that developed agriculture, government, and writing late in its history. We know that our species is a tiny twig of a genealogical tree that embraces all living things and that emerged from prebiotic chemicals almost 4 billion years ago. We know that we live on a planet that revolves around one of 100 billion stars in our galaxy, which is one of 100 billion galaxies in a 13.8 billion year old universe, possibly one of a vast number of universes. We know that our intuitions about space, time, matter, and causation are incommensurable with the nature of reality on scales that are very large and very small. We know that the laws governing the physical world, including accidents, disease, and other misfortunes, have no goals that pertain to human well-being. There is no such thing as fate, providence, karma, spells, curses, augury, divine retribution, or answered prayers, though the discrepancy between the laws of probability and the workings of cognition may explain why people believe there are. And we know that we did not always know these things, that the beloved convictions of every time and culture may be decisively falsified, doubtless including many we hold today. In other words, the worldview that guides the moral and spiritual values of a knowledgeable person today is the worldview given to us by science. Though the scientific facts do not by themselves dictate values, they certainly hem in the possibilities. By stripping ecclesiastical authority of its credibility on factual matters, they cast doubt on its claims to certitude in matters of morality. The scientific refutation of the theory of vengeful gods and occult forces undermines practices such as human sacrifice, witch hunts, faith healing, trial by ordeal, and the persecution of heretics. By exposing the absence of purpose in the laws governing the universe, science forces us to take responsibility for the welfare of ourselves, our species, and our planet. For the same reason, it undercuts any moral or political system based on mystical forces, quests, destinies, dialectics, struggles, or messianic ages. And in combination with a few unexceptionable convictions, that all of us value our own welfare, and that we are social beings who impinge on each other and can negotiate codes of conduct, the scientific facts militate toward a defensible morality, namely principles that maximize the flourishing of humans and other sentient beings. This humanism, chapter 23, which is inextricable from a scientific understanding of the world, is becoming the de facto morality of modern democracies, international organizations, and liberalizing religions, and its unfulfilled promises define the moral imperatives we face today. Though science is increasingly and beneficially embedded in our material, moral, and intellectual lives, many of our cultural institutions cultivate a Philistine indifference to science that shades into contempt. Intellectual magazines that are ostensibly dedicated to ideas confine themselves to politics and the arts, with scant attention to new ideas emerging from science, with the exception of politicized issues like climate change and regular attacks on scientism. Still worse is the treatment of science in the liberal arts curricula of many universities. Students can graduate with a trifling exposure to science, and what they do learn is often designed to poison them against it. The most commonly assigned book on science in modern universities, aside from a popular biology textbook, is Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. That 1962 classic is commonly interpreted as showing that science does not converge on the truth, but merely busies itself with solving puzzles before flipping to some new paradigm which renders its previous theories obsolete, indeed unintelligible. Though Kuhn himself later disavowed this nihilist interpretation, it has become the conventional wisdom within the second culture. A critic from a major intellectual magazine once explained to me that the art world no longer considers whether works of art are beautiful, for the same reason that scientists no longer consider whether theories are true. He seemed genuinely surprised when I corrected him. The historian of science, David Wooten, has remarked on the mores of his own field, "In the years since Snow's lecture, the two cultures problem has deepened. History of science, far from serving as a bridge between the arts and sciences, nowadays offers the scientists a picture of themselves that most of them cannot recognize. That is because many historians of science consider it naive to treat science as the pursuit of true explanations of the world. The result is like a report of a basketball game by a dance critic who is not allowed to say that the players are trying to throw the ball through the hoop. I once sat through a lecture on the semiotics of neuroimaging, at which a historian of science deconstructed a series of dynamic 3D multicolor images of the brain, volubly explaining how that ostensibly neutral and naturalizing scientific gaze encourages particular kinds of selves who are then amenable to certain political agendas, shifting position from the neuropsychological object toward the external observatory position, and so on. Any explanation but the bloody obvious one, namely that the images make it easier to see what's going on in the brain. Many scholars in science studies devote their careers to recondite analyses of how the whole institution is just a pretext for oppression. An example is this scholarly contribution to the world's most pressing challenge. Glaciers, Gender, and Science, a Feminist Glaciology Framework for Global Environmental Change Research. Glaciers are key icons of climate change and global environmental change. However, the relationships among gender, science, and glaciers, particularly related to epistemological questions about the production of glaciological knowledge, remain understudied. This paper thus proposes a feminist glaciology framework with four key components. 1. Knowledge producers. 2. Gendered science and knowledge. 3. Systems of scientific domination. And 4. Alternative representations of glaciers. Merging feminist postcolonial science studies and feminist political ecology, the feminist glaciology framework generates robust analysis of gender, power, and epistemologies in dynamic social ecological systems, thereby leading to more just and equitable science and human-ice interactions. More insidious than the ferreting out of ever more cryptic forms of racism and sexism is a demonization campaign that impugns science, together with reason and other Enlightenment values, for crimes that are as old as civilization, including racism, slavery, conquest, and genocide. This was a major theme of the influential critical theory of the Frankfurt School. The quasi-Marxist movement originated by Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer, who proclaimed that the fully enlightened earth radiates disaster triumphant. It also figures in the works of postmodernist theorists such as Michel Foucault, who argued that the Holocaust was the inevitable culmination of a biopolitics that began with the Enlightenment, when science and rational governance exerted increasing power over people's lives. In a similar vein, the sociologist Zygmunt Bauman blamed the Holocaust on the Enlightenment ideal to remake the society, force it to conform to an overall, scientifically conceived plan. In this twisted narrative, the Nazis themselves are let off the hook. It's modernity's fault. So is the Nazis' rapidly counter-Enlightenment ideology, which despised the degenerate liberal bourgeois worship of reason and progress and embraced an organic pagan vitality, which drove the struggle between races. Though critical theory and postmodernism avoid scientistic methods such as quantification and systematic chronology, the facts suggest they have the history backwards. Genocide and autocracy were ubiquitous in pre-modern times, and they decreased, not increased, as science and liberal Enlightenment values became increasingly influential after World War II. To be sure, science has often been pressed into the support of deplorable political movements. It is essential, of course, to understand this history, and legitimate to pass judgment on scientists for their roles in it, just like any historical figures. Yet the qualities that we prize in humanities scholars, context, nuance, historical depth, often leave them when the opportunity arises to prosecute a campaign against their academic rivals. Science is commonly blamed for intellectual movements that had a pseudo-scientific patina, though the historical roots of those movements ran deep and wide. Scientific racism, the theory that races fall into an evolutionary hierarchy of mental sophistication with Northern Europeans at the top, is a prime example. It was popular in the decades flanking the turn